To be honest, my whole hope for the AI revolution, Boaz, is AI should make it so people have to work less, but make better decisions around the things that people are good at and let machines do a lot of the busy work.
Hi, my name is Boaz, and I'm the CEO of Simply Augmented. I'm super excited that you're tuned in today for the Shift AI podcast. On today's episode, we have Rand Fishkin. Rand is the CEO of SparkToro and one of the most respected entrepreneurs in the Seattle area. If you're someone that's interested in the way that marketing and AI fit into the startup landscape, and also interested in a very unique perspective on how to grow and run a startup, you won't want to miss this episode. Super excited to talk to Rand today. Let's get to it. All right, Rand, nice to see you. Thanks for joining the Shift AI podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure, Boaz. Good to be here.
I'm excited to talk with you today. Before we get started, I just want to kind of introduce you to the audience. You are the co-founder of SEO Moz, co-founder of Moz, and now you are the also co-founder and CEO of SparkToro. Did I get that all right?
All correct. Yeah, SEO Moz. This is a throwback.
And you know, not only that, but I want to talk to you about your new book as well, Lost and Founder. I know you're the author of Lost and Founder. We'll get into that. Is there anything else that that I'm missing?
I mean, technically, I'm also the co-founder and creative director of a video game studio, but it hasn't been announced yet. It's sort of still in half stealth mode. So, at some point, I'll have more on that.
One of the things I like to set up on the show is, you know, it is a show about AI. It's a show about the future of work. I know that there's a lot of interesting things that we can talk about relative to startups and the startup ecosystem. But the first question is, what was your first job that you actually got paid?
Let's see. I worked for about a year in college at the Wizards of the Coast Game Center. So
I remember the Wizards of the Coast on University Ave.
Yep, on University Way, exactly. Yeah, so I was the secretary slash receptionist at the front desk. So a lot of strange and interesting characters would come to that place to play their board games or their Dungeons and Dragons or their Magic the Gathering. Pokemon was really big when I was there. And so in addition to getting my $4.25 an hour paycheck, which at the time was enough to afford an apartment in the university district.
Wow.
So I could pay my rent and my bills on that. No college student can possibly work retail and pay for their housing anymore, which is a crime. But I also used my employee discount to buy Pokemon cards because Seattle was one of the few places you could get them in the country, and then resell them on eBay and Craigslist for a markup of, sometimes 50%.
So you had a little Pokemon card side hustle going.
Exactly. So a lot of paychecks, I was like trying to save as much as I could so I could buy more Pokemon cards so I could sell them online. And yep, exactly.
How about your favorite job? Is it now?
Definitely now. Oh my God. by a mile. No, I love what I do. I love working with Casey and Amanda at SparkToro. It's a very chill job. It is, I think what's great about it is that rather than requiring high work intensity, it instead demands high quality decision making. And that is much, I'd much rather put my labor into making the best decisions that I possibly can and sort of being rewarded, whatever, you know, financially, product-wise, customer-wise, happiness-wise, based on that decision-making versus put in lots of hours.
Yeah.
And I think that optimization can apply to a lot of tech and, you know, leadership and management and product jobs. To be honest, my whole hope for the AI revolution, Boaz, is AI should make it so people have to work less, but make better decisions around the things that people are good at and let machines do a lot of the busy work.
Yeah, I want to talk more about that. But I also want the audience to understand how your past companies have kind of factored into your philosophy about this new company. So just take the audience back a little bit to SEO Moz and those years. I mean, you did that for a long time. You're a fixture in the Seattle community. I've been following your work for a really long time, but I know that that you've been thinking a lot about this business in relation to the experience that you had in that first business. So can you explore that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So for folks who aren't familiar, the SEO software company Moz, which is a relatively sizable business, was originally a blog that I started called SEO Moz, SEOMoz.org. Boaz, one of the few seven people on the planet who read the old SEO Moz blog and remembers that name. So that happened after I dropped out of the University of Washington, which was about a year after I was doing the Wizards of the Coast Game Center thing. Was designing websites with my mom. She had run a small business marketing consultancy in Seattle for 20 years, and I was building the websites for her clients as the web was sort of taking off. And then we had been subcontracting SEO work, search engine optimization, right? Getting into, at the time, it was like Yahoo and MSN Search and Ask Jeeves and this nascent newcomer, Google. And we did not have a successful business and struggled quite a bit to make ends meet. We went deeply into debt, and we could not pay our subcontractors. So we had promised this work to clients, and that is how I learned SEO, because I had to, because we had basically promised clients who had already paid us, hey, we're going to, you know, do your SEO work. And then we didn't have the money to pay our subcontractors to do the work. So it fell on me.
Yeah.
And that's how I started the SEO Moz blog, which became mildly popular in sort of a very niche space. And then some investors reached out and asked, you know, hey, would you ever want to take this thing and do more with it? We had built some software that had started getting a little bit of traction as a self-service SaaS business, very early in self-service SaaS. You know, the only people that VCs could really compare us to was like Netflix, right? It was a subscription business, not a enterprise SaaS. And that business really took off. Ignition Partners, Michelle Goldberg, invested in us here in the Seattle area. And we basically grew very fast, you know, 100% year over year for 7-8 years in a row, got to around 30 million plus in annual revenue and tens of thousands of customers and, you know, a team of 150 folks. And then I stepped down from the CEO role at Moz during a bout with depression. So I talked to my board members and was like, hey, I don't think I'm the guy. And I think I'm sort of dragging down performance. And I selected my successor, who was my chief operating officer. Unfortunately, the next 4 years were pretty rough, both for me and for the business. You know, Moz continued to grow, but much more slowly than it had previously, kind of plateaued. And I left in 2018, which is when Lost and Founder was published and SparkToro was started the next day, the day after I left Moz.
Well, maybe it's a good time to kind of talk about Lost and Founder, because it sounds like a lot of that book was learnings and experiences and shares from that time that you had. So can you talk to the audience about that and explain your perspective in that book?
Yeah. I think my biggest goal with it was to share a vulnerable and honest story of running a VC-backed business that was not a complete failure, right? I mean, 95 out of 100 venture-backed businesses do worse than Moz did, but hopefully in a portfolio of 100, one or two do much, much, much better than what Moz did. And being that sort of stuck in the middle type of business is a challenging and frustrating experience. And in talking to a lot of the other folks who were, you know, in the venture portfolios with us and many, many other entrepreneurs who had started and worked at venture-backed businesses and tried to fundraise and all those kinds of things. What I learned is that my experience was tragically better than most. And so I wanted to try and pull back the curtain on what this type of world looks like and offer insight and helpful suggestions and things that worked for me, things that didn't work for us, and Yeah. So the book is 18 individual stories that happen relatively sequentially over the course of the company's life and kind of tell painfully honest versions of the reality of being in those trenches and things that went well and things that went poorly. So there's a lot of, I would say, company building and marketing and product advice. And there's also a lot of be careful what you get yourself into.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of startup founders that listen to this podcast. So I think that's something that a lot of people are wondering, you know, and there's a several people that are first-time founders that are getting into this that don't really understand venture. And that sounds like an amazing experience, sure.
I mean, my biggest frustration, Boaz, with the venture asset class is it's marketed and sold as though it's the only game in town, right? That essentially you have two options. You're a bootstrapped lifestyle business. Aren't you cute and adorable and no one should really pay attention to you and you're not important and don't matter. And you're a real business. You're trying to be something serious and big and exciting, especially in tech. And so therefore you must be going after venture. Those are the only two options. And that binary is wrong. It is a story sold by people who desperately need hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs like you and I to participate in that ecosystem and try and build companies because their model, you know, needs 500 failed entrepreneurs for every one who succeeds. And I think that's fundamentally a really bad bet for founders. And I would encourage almost no one to go that path. What's weird is most venture capitalists say the same thing, right? They say VC is wrong for almost every company. But if you're really special, like if you're amazing, then, you know, then come talk to me and I'll tell you if you're amazing, right? I decide if you are worthwhile. You don't decide. It's not your accomplishments that matter. It's whether I back you or not.
Well, this is a good segue to SparkToro. I mean, I think that we've talked about some of your different philosophies about the business, about how you go to market, and also your just different philosophy around how you set up this company. So maybe let's talk a little bit about what SparkToro is, and then also let's kind of feed back into the way that you think about company culture relative to, you know, what you just talked about.
Yeah, yeah. So SparkToro, we have this sort of informal philosophy that we call chill work. Which okay. I was sharing with someone earlier today. That might be the title of my second book. The chill work philosophy is essentially what we were talking about before, right? That you optimize for a business that requires high quality decision making over high amounts of hours and work input. It is a business that is designed to optimize for the lives that we want to lead, the founders, rather than optimized for growth at all costs or maximizing a particular growth rate or extracting the most, you know, financial value from a particular sector. We also believe, interestingly, and I think, you know, probably some VCs would disagree, we believe that by serving ourselves, serving our customers, and our team before we sort of prioritize maximizing investor returns, we will actually build a better company, a company that is more likely to do better at maximizing investor returns, but in the long run rather than the short run. Like we, you know, what we want is a business that's around for 10, 20, 30 years that earns its investors 5, 10, 20x their money and does it in a very weird way. Does it in a way that is not you get nothing for, you know, 15 years and then one day SparkToro is sold and you either make out like a bandit or you got diluted too much in the process and you didn't participate in the future rounds and, you know, whatever the new share classes made the old share class worthless and that, you know, all the stuff that happens to traditional startups. Our model instead is... Okay, so in May of this year, Boaz, if you were an investor in SparkToro, let's say you put $50,000 into SparkToro, which is pretty much the average amount that most of our 35 private angel investors, a lot of folks like yourself, right, put in between $25,000 and $100,000, you got your $50,000 back, It was essentially a five-year loan with no interest rate.
Okay.
Now you get to participate in profit sharing pro rata. So let's say you own, 1% of, you know, the outstanding units in the SparkToro LLC. Hopefully in a couple of years, Casey and I are going to send you another check for $25,000. And so now you've made 50% on your investment. And then hopefully in another 3 or 4 years, you get another check like that. And two or 3 years later, you get another one. And so, you know, every few years, you're getting a nice chunk of change on your investment. And our goal is to remain profitable that entire time, right? To never need to raise another round, never dilute our investors or ourselves. Yeah. And that's also how we make money. You know, Casey and I have in our operating agreement, our salaries are capped. We can't just pay ourselves more money if the business does really well. The only way we make more money is if we pay dividends to everyone, and we only make money after we've paid back our investors. So it's this very shared risk, shared goal. Everybody's on board with the, hey, how do we keep SparkToro alive and profitable for a really long time? Because that's how we're going to make money from this business. And you know what's beautiful about that? That's also how you do a great job serving customers.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Like the venture model sort of demands the, what Cory Doctorow has named the inshittification of the web. Okay. Right, where essentially the early customers are also the first ones to get screwed when you go after the new set of customers. And then the new set of customers get screwed when you sort of replace them. And you can see this, right, in everything from Netflix to Google to Amazon to Facebook and Apple, et cetera.
Well, I can see why the long-term strategy makes sense, because as an investor in that model, I would want you going for as long as possible if I keep getting paid, you know, every 3 years.
And, you know, if the business sells, it's not a, right? If somebody buys SparkToro, you know, you get your pro rata dividend from that as well, right? You get the payment there too. But certainly once you get your money back, you're sort of like, yeah, just keep paying me those checks, right? It's a, you know what I relate it to? I don't know if you own any public stocks or do any, you know, have an investment portfolio or whatever, but a lot of people who invest in the public stock market have a, you know, set of growth stocks that they invest in, you know, like a Google or whatever, right? Where they expect it to hopefully go up from where it is today. And then they have dividend stocks, which are not going to go up very much. That's not how they're going to make money. You know, a 3M or something, right? And it's like, okay, well, you own a share. And so you're going to get your 3 cent every quarter payment as a dividend. And maybe it'll be 4 cents. And so you made a little more than you thought you would per share. Yeah. And that's what we think SparkToro can be. And I believe that the startup world deserves thousands, tens of thousands of companies who are dividend focused. They're lower risk than the venture types of investments. And the returns that you make are more around this profitable, sustainable model. It's sort of something I hope to, you know, I hope at the end of my professional career, I can look back and be like, hey, look, there's a few dozen companies or a few hundred companies or, knock on wood, a few thousand companies that are doing that.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, to talk about your value proposition in SparkToro and your brand promise to your customers.
Yeah. You mean the product itself, what it does, who it serves. Yeah. So SparkToro is also in marketing software, but not in SEO specifically. So SparkToro is audience research. So we essentially tell you the behaviors, demographics, and characteristics of a describable group of people on the internet. So you might say, for example, I want to know the demographics and behaviors and characteristics of chemical engineers in the UK, or of interior designers in California, or of people who play Dungeons and Dragons, or fans of science fiction books. Yeah. And SparkToro can tell you about all of those audiences, right? It can say like, oh, well, here's, you know, a gender and age and education breakdown. Here's geographically where those people are. And here's skills and interests that they have. And here's websites that they visit, social accounts that they follow, podcasts they listen to, YouTube channels they subscribe to. Very helpful for usually marketers who are trying to reach those people in the places where they pay attention with a message that they're going to care about.
Yeah, it makes sense. And it's a subscription model.
It is, yeah. So we start at $50 a month, which, so we're on the, you know, we're on the very low end of that market. You can, for example, if you wanted to pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to Brandwatch, they have an excellent product. I think the world of what they're building, but also it's totally unaffordable to 95% of marketers, right? So we apply that kind of philosophy of, you know, chill work and self-service and helping the little guy, right, to our product as well.
To that end, though, one of the things I was really interested in asking you with all your marketing experience is, you know, as a founder or a small business or, you know, an entrepreneur that's thinking about marketing and kind of coming up, what would be your advice to them as they go to market and try to figure out how to reach the right customer?
Most of the time, whenever people say like, hey, how would I market a startup? What advice do you have for startup founders? My advice is marketing is so unique to every business, every audience, every customer set, that if anyone tells you, hey, you should do this, they're probably wrong, right? Mm. Unless they know your business deeply and intimately, they're probably wrong. And so universal advice is almost always terrible. That said, my one bit of advice here would be, if you can find marketing channels and tactics that are at the intersection of three things, you should invest in those. And those three things are, one, you have personal passion and interest around that sector. So for example, Boaz, if you told me, this would be ironic, but if you told me, ugh, I hate podcasts, talking to people over video on the internet is terrible, I hate the sound of my voice, you know, guests are so boring, I'd tell you, well, that's probably a bad channel for you to invest in. I've never heard of someone who said, man, I hate podcasting, but I'm really good at it. it doesn't happen, right? So same thing. If you told me, I can't stand Instagram, well, don't do your marketing there. The beautiful thing about being a startup, an early stage company, you only need to pick one or two channels and tactics to be really good at. And if you hate SEO, don't do that. If you hate content marketing, don't do that. But do find the one place, the two places, the three places where you have passion and interest. Second one is you got to pick something that actually reaches your customers. Mm-hmm. So if you told me, for example, hey, I'm really, you know, passionate about marketing through Pinterest. And I would say, gosh, you know, unfortunately, I don't think there's a lot of participation in the sort of world of startup tech, AI on Pinterest. Like, it's just not a platform where a lot of that happens. Maybe a teeny tiny bit, but that's going to be a real stretch. I would look for other opportunities to leverage that same passion and interest into, you know, maybe you take your visuals and you put them on LinkedIn instead, right? That kind of thing.
Totally.
And then the third one is you have unique value in that sector that no one else is providing, right? So, you know, if I said to you like, Boaz, what is the unique value proposition of your podcast or your whatever Pinterest channel or your YouTube channel, what is it that people get from your channel that they can't get anywhere else or anywhere else
That's
as well?
A big one. Yeah.
And if you have a great answer to all three of those, you've got a great set of channels and tactics.
Yeah. I love that approach because I think a lot of people feel like they have to be everywhere.
You know who I blame? Gary Vaynerchuk. I think he's actually toned down some of his rhetoric around this. But Gary Vee for a long time has been like, you got to be everywhere. You got to be hustling every platform,
high volume,
every day.
Everywhere. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great advice. Well, it kind of makes me think about some of the things that are happening in the AI space too. And you started the show by talking a little bit about that. But I'd love to get your perspective on what's happened in this last year around large language models, around AI. I know you have a perspective on it. What do you think about what's happening and how does that apply to your work in marketing, but just in general?
Yeah. So I think it's quite frustrating because I think that AI, unlike some of the previous tech hype cycles around, for example, like you know, cryptocurrency or NFTs or several of the others, the augmented reality, virtual reality spaces, metaverse, all that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we've had so many of these, I don't want to call them completely false bubbles, but what feel like bubbles in tech. When AI became, generative AI in particular, became hugely popular, there were a lot of skeptics who looked at it and said, well, it's probably going to be like these other six or seven that have popped up in the last few years. And I don't think that's completely fair. I think that generative AI is an incredibly powerful, useful, and interesting tool. And it probably also got somewhat overhyped, maybe by 50% instead of 99%, but it did get overhyped. And so there were, you can see this in the behavior of generative AI tools, right? ChatGPT and Bard, and then all the others that flow from them, that essentially there's this massive adoption curve, December, January, February, March of this year now, into April and May. And then we started to see a decline, and that decline has continued into September. Who knows what October will be like? Maybe it'll, you know, pick back up again. But the height of that curve was April, May, and now we're seeing declining usage and traffic and visitation. But when we say declining from 50 to 100 million people using those every month, right, to more like 20 or 30 million, which is still massive. Like, if you think about what 30 million people, that's basically 10% of all adult Americans using, right, some generative AI tool. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Mind-blowing how popular and powerful these tools are. What I will say is I think there are use cases that make a ton of sense. A lot of them around programming, right? I think if you're a programmer and you're not using AI in some ways, you're probably missing out. Right? Like, it can absolutely save you time and do tasks for you. I think the same is true for a lot of data analysts and researchers. Certainly almost anyone who's doing any type of whatever categorization or filtering or complex work in Excel or Sheets, generative AI is fantastic. In marketing, I worry.
Tell me more.
To be honest, I really worry, Boaz, about marketing use cases because generative AI, large language models, are good at telling you what word or what tokens are most likely to come after which previous tokens. That's the right. That's how the systems function. Yeah. And so it's very difficult to get unique things that have never been seen before. Yeah. And most of what works really well in marketing is, to our point earlier, unique, right? It's unique value, unique insight, new writing on a topic, new ideas. Right. Those are not AI's strengths.
And the more generic, the harder it's going to be to break out from the pack. You know what's interesting, though? Two things. One, I recently saw some data that SparkToro uncovered about usage patterns of AI. And I think that's worth mentioning because a lot of it pointed to developers using copilots, and it was still high numbers for the marketers using it and for people creating content for email writing and blog writing and so on. But you really saw some interesting numbers come through. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So what we did is worked with a clickstream data provider, Datos, who provides the underpinnings for a big part of our new V2 that's coming soon. And Datos essentially has folks who opt into their 10 million user panel. And so they can see all the URLs that they visit. And many of those folks also opted into sharing their ChatGPT prompts, right? And their responses. So essentially we're looking at these, you know, big web pages of ChatGPT, like full back and forth prompt and response series. I think we looked at 8,000 of them. We filtered that down to like 6,000 that actually looked like they were realistic usage, right? Real uses of the product. The other 2,500 or so that we looked at were more like, tell me a bunch of swears. As we looked at this, we categorized those 8,000, looked at the usage over time. These specific responses were April and May. So the 8,000 that we looked at were sort of during the height of ChatGPT's popularity. And then we classified each of the use cases into broader and more narrow groups. And then I went through several hundred of each category manually, looking at them and reviewing. And, you know, a lot of people, almost 40% of use was for programming assistance.
Wow. That's a lot more than I thought. I thought more people were using it for content generation around, you know, email writing, blog posting. And so when you told me that it was 40%, I thought, wow, that's amazing.
The breakdown is pretty fascinating, right? So we can see, yeah, so 30% programming, about 23% education. And when I say education, that is three really kind of different categories. One would be professional education. Like, I want to learn about this thing in my industry. I'm a chemical engineer. You know, tell me molecular components of silica gel or that kind of thing. Higher education, so college level coursework types of responses and questions, and then primary education and homework. And those, you know, those make up the next biggest one. And then we get to content, which is about half and half personal and professional. So personal being, can you, you know, write an emotionless email to my ex-husband about our childcare situation or that kind of stuff, right?
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about chill work in the context of remote work and company culture, because as much as this show is about AI, it's also about the future of work and how work is changing for people. I think one of the things that you touched on, which is interesting, is I also think that we can spend a lot more time being creative and being strategic. And my hope is that AI will function as that assistant that used to be maybe a junior person in your company, but now could also be a machine. I'm interested in how you think about remote first companies in the context of this new company that you have and just company culture in general.
Let's see. I think that the history of company culture, especially the, you know, sort of 20th century model, was very much that company and work culture were also tied to your socialization and personal identity and value in the world, right? So how people saw themselves as, why do I exist as a human being? What am I? Who am I? I think over the last 20 years, that has been shifting for at least a large portion of Americans. I think that it never quite caught on in Europe, right? Europeans were never quite as much a, my job defines who I am and what I am and why I exist. And other parts of the world, you know, varying degrees of difference there. The last 20 years have untethered those two things. And I think remote first and remote work in general is a natural extension of both that social trend and also the physical reality of how difficult and uncomfortable we've made commuting, how expensive we've made real estate in places where you might want to live and work, cost of living situations, and I think a backlash against the company as family model, which, you know, I think that that model worked quite well for the second half of the 20th century because the promise that companies generally made to their employees was fulfilled often enough that many American workers felt like it was a real commitment, right?
Yeah, you know, makes sense. What,
my dad went to work at Boeing in 1979. He worked there 30 years to the week. He got his, you know, gold watch and his pension and he left. Right.
Yeah.
And that is almost impossible to find. You will not find that loyalty from employees. You don't expect it from employers anymore. And so this whole work as family, companies as family thing, just not realistic. And I think remote recognizes that, right? It says basically like, hey, you're going to contribute your labor in the ways that work best for you and around your life, whether that's family and kids or friends or other responsibilities, hobbies, interests, passions, side hustles. Great, right? Like life and work can coexist. We recognize as an employer that your life is not your job. And you recognize as an employee that, you know, we live in an at-will country, right? And you get let go anytime.
And even as a small team, which you guys are now, you've talked to me about ways that you think about chill work and remote work and the ability to do those things in the context of your company, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, we're, you know, we're just completely, I don't know, different on all these vectors, Boaz. Like, not, you know, we don't follow a lot of traditional lines. So for example, SparkToro's, you know, was growing quite well. It's quite profitable. It seems like the kind of business where, you know, if it were venture backed, you would say, hey, let's put some more money into this thing, right? Mm-hmm. Let's go step on the gas, as VCs like to say. And we've chosen to do the opposite, right? Yeah. We put it on cruise control. We actually dialed back our goals for this year for a couple of reasons. One was that we kind of had to rebuild the engine on which SparkToro was built after Elon destroyed Twitter. And that was one of our central data components. And so now we're moving to other sources. And Amanda, you know, the third person who works at SparkToro, is on parental leave. So we were like, okay, well, hey, we're gonna slow it down. Like, it's gonna be barely a growth year, which is fine. Like, we make plenty of money and we're doing great and we're happy to serve our customers. And
so when you think about emerging technologies in the future of work, 5-10 years out, what are some of the things that excites you? How do you think about it? And looking into the future, where do you think this is all going?
I get excited. This is so weird, but I get really excited about antitrust. Like, I am.
Really?
Yeah. I am really hopeful that a renewed interest from both parties in the United States, right? Remember that the trial against Google that's going on right now was initiated by the Trump administration. And I don't have very many positive things to say about that administration, but this would be one of them, right? I would say that they correctly identified that Google's monopoly behavior and their abuse of their monopoly power in search denigrated opportunities for small and medium businesses and any competitors in all sorts of sectors. And I think that sucks. And I think that antitrust law in the United States has been around for 125 years, and it has not been fairly applied to these big tech companies. That whole thing sucks, right? So I'm pretty hopeful that, for example, if Google, let's say, you know, next month, Google were broken up into three companies, YouTube, Google Maps, and Google Search. And those three companies competed with each other. I bet you would have more innovation on the internet space, right? Of traffic, of discovery, of how people find brands and learn about products and services than you've had in the last 15 years. Huh. Same thing is true with Amazon. You know, the FTC just filed a suit with, I think, 18 different states this week that we're having this conversation against Amazon, alleging that they abuse their monopoly power and sort of, you know, how they use their logistics and scale and Prime to prevent competition in the e-commerce space. I bet we would see incredible innovation, a ton more brands, a lot more small and medium businesses succeeding. And that's what excites me most about the potential future. The promise of the internet to me, Boaz, was anyone can get on the web. Anyone can reach everyone.
Yeah.
I love that idea. I think that is beautiful. I think what Jimmy Wales imagined, you know, people like, you know, those, the early innovators of the web, the creators, imagined is possible. I even think it's alive. It's just not as popular as it should be. My mug is from Mastodon. Mastodon, in my opinion, is the very best social network out there, right? It is completely open source. Anyone can build with it. You can federate and defederate. It works like email. Yeah. Another incredible technology. And I would love to see innovation in those sectors. I don't know if AI will enable that, but I hope it does. I hope it makes a few passionate people so productive and gives them, you know, the ability to do things that only big teams and big investments could previously do. That excites me.
That's awesome. I mean, it goes back to your advocacy for small businesses and small startups that, I mean, I can hear the passion in your voice.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, for any of your listeners or for you, like, we all live in Seattle, right? You don't go to Starbucks. Like, you know, the coffee's terrible and right, the product and the brand, like, it's not good. But man, that like little startup or coffee shop around the corner that, you know, only has two locations and they roast their own beans. Oh, yeah. I love it. Microbreweries. I love
that's
them.
Your place.
Yeah. You know, small retail stores. Oh, what a great experience. The Pike Place Market, right? If you have two locations, you're not allowed to be in Pike Place Market unless you're, you know, grandparented in. But I think that whole principle, that whole philosophy, that's what we want.
So my last question for you, I ask this question to everybody on the show. You can take a minute to pause if you want and then elaborate, is if you were going to explain the future of work in two words, what would those two words be?
Different for everyone, which I think is beautiful, right? The whole concept of work serving people rather than people serving their jobs and their work is that you should be able to have the experience that works for you and your life and your situation. And that, you know, that demands a lot of diversity in all the senses, right? Diversity of experience, diversity of opportunity. There's a lot of things that I really, really dislike about capitalism. But the one thing I think is absolutely beautiful and inspiring is that freedom to put your labor where you want. I have a nephew who's a staunch communist, and I'm always like, okay, but then the day after the election, you just wait at home until the party tells you what your job is. I don't like that, right? I'm not into that. I get the equality thing, but
it
doesn't sit well. Like I want that freedom to put my labor where I think there's demand and interest and to be, you know, rewarded based on the quality of my labor and the quality of my ideas and whether I choose good market spaces and all of that, right? And that, I think the free market still has a lot to offer humanity, but the trend with big business and late stage capitalism has really been going the wrong way. So if we can turn it around, that'd be beautiful.
Different for everyone. Rand, I really appreciate you coming on to the show. And I really think your perspective is an interesting one. And I think a lot of audience members will agree. And I appreciate you taking the time. Great to have you on.
My pleasure, Boaz. I suspect I'm very different from a lot of your other guests. But hopefully in a valuable way.
Okay, that's a wrap. It was really great to have Rand on the podcast today. I really appreciate his perspective on how to run startups. And I also thought it was really interesting to understand the way that he thinks about marketing analytics. If you're interested in what Rand has to say, please make sure to follow him on Twitter and LinkedIn. As always, the Shift AI podcast is brought to you by Simply Augmented, and the theme music is by Dave Angel.